Well, thank you very much. I think this has been fascinating, a succession of little bullets of perspective and also illustration. And I suspect, not least, we learned an awful lot more about NICE than many of us knew before in the telescopic 10 minutes on my left here. What I'd like to do first is to ask our panel whether they have any quick responses to each other. Something that was burning in your mind as you heard your colleague speak, and you wanted to say no or yes or something in between the two.
I did, because I think, Daniel, I think you're absolutely right that the problem is so huge that it does need some large-scale change. So things like complete service redesign. But I think it also needs resource release in medical technologies. And I think, certainly I can remember having a conversation with a really big sort of global board bloke from a global medtech company. I was telling him all about our exciting new programme where we were looking at, evaluating technologies that released resources. And he says, there's no such thing as a resource-releasing medical technology or medical device, just one that's been mispriced, was his view. So there is still a bit of a kind of need for us.
As it so happens, I've got one in my pocket. This was invented by one of Jim's colleagues who consulted an anaesthetist. And if I'm anemic, if I think you're anemic, I would send you to the nurse to get a blood sample. Blood sample would go into a taxi. A taxi would take it to a hospital. Hospital would do an investigation. At some point tomorrow, I'll get a phone call if this person is anemic or not. This device here, if I think you're anemic, I take a bit of blood, squirt it in here. Within 10 seconds, I know if you're anemic or not. 10 seconds. So I take away a whole process, a whole pathway, and a whole lot of costs as well. So the technology already exists. That was the warehouse I was showing there. So my argument is, why is stuff like this not being implemented? This is 20 years old, by the way. Why is it not being implemented? Because it's great to hear what NICE is doing. There is still no shared vision. It's not coming together. There's pockets of stuff happening, but my argument is politicians are absent and so on. There's bits of information that Alison's in and so on, but there's no, in Baldrick's word, there's no common plan. Nothing is coming together. And that's the bit that I'm concerned about. There's no sense of direction. That's the area we need to go into.
Any other quick responses on other things that have been burning on people's... Yes?
I'm interested. What's the triage system for a 25% cut? I mean, where do you begin to think, I wouldn't know where to start.
I know, and luckily
it's
not.
It's massive.
Well, we've already made 22.5% cut at NICE in the last 2 years, so I think you can do it. It's just not particularly comfortable, especially because people still expect you to do a thoroughly fine job, which of course we do, but that's the task the NHS has got because of the pressures from increased morbidity and sort of flat inflation uplifts.
May I add, for me, this is being a participant of observer a number of years ago, that because of the way that the NHS functions, it does actually disempower you as a patient. You are completely passive in the process. And actually, that is where I think the wastage occurs, because actually, if you were given information, for example, if you made the appointments, if you actually had control of data, you're shut out of that process the whole time. So actually, there's no inclination, for example, for you to even have an idea about whether you miss an appointment, because actually it's all happening anyway. So I sort of feel, in one sense, if you could get people to actually have more access and ownership over their health, and that's, and that can be in small ways through things like, data, there's so much data available. Simple things, a report from your GP each year. Things like that would really actually make, again, it's a touch point of value that people would realise that they're not just something being moved through a system. I've got a student working with a GP practice at the moment in the Midlands, and the student is looking at, again, how they can stop the patients from overbooking appointments. this is not, you know, this is not rocket science. This is about the behaviour of actually confidence, how much contact, whether the GPs even understand the family profiles of the people that they're treating. So I think there's some sort of interesting sort of, the human dimension I think is often missing in these conversations.
Let me ask, plainly, part of the value of the NHS as a sort of a global conversation, and I speak as someone who lives much of my time in the States now, is because it is a unitary entity, because it is ultimately a government-controlled entity, cost issues and broader cultural issues. I mean, you have this, there's a sort of huge test bed here in which we can have these conversations. Pretty much all other medical systems are a little more loosey-goosey than the NHS is. They're less controlled, there's more of a public-private dimension to them. Of course, in the States, you have the other extreme, where you have parts of the healthcare system are actually very government, like the VA and some other parts of it. It isn't that the NHS is completely different from these US systems. But my question is, given the kind of cost pressures pushing up and the kind of budget pressures pushing down, that you're operating in a sort of pressure cooker context, and NICE basically is the you know, play with the metaphor in various ways, you're the valve or something. But you have this unitary context within which to be having this conversation. Now, are you finding that in the various ways you participate in this? Are you finding this as sort of healthy? You know, we're all in this together. We must be multidisciplinary. We must get medical anthropologists, you know, talking to designers, talking to economists, you know, talking to administrators, talking to. I mean, is that emerging as, if you like, the pressure builds, as cost pushes keep pushing way up, and as budget goes down? I mean, is that what is emerging, or is something much more toxic coming out of it?
I think that's a very good point, because think back to where I began a few minutes ago. I think that the problem with environments in which people see costs being cut is that oftentimes they may be forced into cooperating at some level. It may actually leave them with a sense of having been punished, to the extent that something good coming out of that may take a very, very long time to emerge, because especially if they feel that they've otherwise been betrayed with respect to feeling that they were fulfilling their expectations and obligations to their best. And I think that here one of the things we often forget about in terms of implementing innovation is that is the need to preserve things that are working well, and how do you honor, you know, the good efforts of people who are trying to make are trying actually to make things work, as a way of at least decreasing the damaging effects that you point to here.
We're going to open us up in a few minutes. So if you want to be thinking about your focused and clear questions and not speeches, you have an opportunity in just a moment. You can be preparing yourselves. Daniel made this point about hospitals as the temples of technology, and that was he, wasn't it? Yes, it was. And your wish to push medicine back, if you like, where it was pre-tech, into something which is not focused on these great, you know, technology-based and money-absorbing institutions, which are impersonal and so on and so forth. I mean, say a little bit more about how you might see that working. If we flash forward 15 years, I mean, how do you see, if what you would like to happen there happens?
I think the point is even more complex. It's actually about I'm not advocating to go back to the Middle Ages whatsoever. It's actually about technology has pushed the patient away into a process. And it's for the patient, the people, to come out again and actually be part or controlling or whatever, take ownership of what's going to happen to them. The point I'm going to make is about ecosystems. I find it very historic that we're in Charles Darwin's building. And Charles Darwin is about evolution. To confuse you more, my background was not just ex-clinical. I worked in the car industry as well. If you look at industry, innovation is a must. If you don't innovate like Rover didn't, you know, you're dead. So Tesco's, Jaguar and so on, Apple, they have to innovate. If they don't do it, then they're dead. To me, the NHS is new to innovation. It's the National Health Service. It just tries to get people better. It's not about innovation at all. It hasn't been in the past. Every time there was something wrong with the NHS. Government was good enough to put more money into the system. And it bred, I think, an ecosystem of industry that's not able to do innovation either. So suddenly now, we're actually asking this whole system to change and become innovation-centered. And that's, you know, I think, the enormity of the whole challenge. So don't get me wrong, I'm not saying go back to the Middle Ages, but put technology in its rightful place. Yes.
Well, I like the Middle Ages. I mean, it's not my point. But it seems to me that you know, recreating the relationships which used to drive medicine, and which still drives medicine in much of the world where there's very little technology, because technology has a sort of epiphenomenal relationship to healing and health. We place far too much confidence in it. And, of course, the hospital symbolises the problem. Let me ask one more question, then we're going to open this up. Social media. Now, social media, obviously, I was tweeting out the more memorable comments we made earlier on. Some of you are picking up on this. Social media is revolutionising everything in one way or another. And I take a rather positive view of the way in which social media can be engaged. Now, of course, we have government 2.0, which is a term being very widely used. Open government, and the government here in the UK has taken a lot of strides in particularly in making data available. This has been a huge development here and in some other countries like the US. We talk about Enterprise 2.0. This is a phrase from, I think, Andrew McAfee from MIT. But it's basically thinking of business in terms of social media not simply being available for, you know, dealing with problems and marketing and so on, but as a way to engage the markets, emerging markets, with product development, innovation, changing corporate culture, Enterprise 2.0. Now, to what extent are social media enabling or able to enable this recreation of the fresh, more personal relationship and the dynamic culture, which is what's laying behind much of this conversation?
I have something to say about that. I mean, one of the things that very much interests me as a medical anthropologist, it used to be the case 15 or 20 years ago, I'm working on a homeless project where you could walk into an A&E and you basically have people who had primary health care provision and people who didn't have it. And today, you now have a third category of people who are highly self-medicated. That is to say, people who are essentially working outside of the system, either because they can't be provided for, there's not enough to go around. They are taking ownership, for better or worse, with sometimes quite defective information. And frequently this leads both to potential for innovation, some of the most interesting innovation. You know, people used to say 10 years ago, well, you know, we shouldn't put things on mobile phones because then poor people, and especially the homeless, couldn't avail themselves. And well, if you walk into the homeless shelter, that's the first thing a person buys today is a mobile phone, because you can find out where you can actually resource services spontaneously. So sometimes there are innovations that are taking place at that level, but I think what's interesting here is the fact that you have these hybrid circumstances that previously were virtually non-existent.
Other comments on that?
I suppose in a way, just going back to my point that we have, you know, the National Health Service, but actually if one looks at any of the principles of what a service is about, which is actually you need to take something away with you, that in fact, as I said, that you need to create an experience. Because of the machinery of the NHS, it does that on one level that serves actually the NHS and perhaps doesn't serve or doesn't maximise creating a more personal service for patients. And I think actually, you know, on taking Daniel's point, the changes to achieve that will be enormous, but I do think you can do it through, for example, small demonstration projects, and I think, for example, whether it's with GP practices who want to try new ways of using social media to connect to their patients. And if there wasn't the sort of anxiety, or there is a lot of anxiety about data protection and privacy and all these things, actually, I think there's opportunity there for people to make those decisions on whether they want to actually participate in, you know, having their access to their data or not. And I think often privacy and all these things are just used as a way to prevent innovation occurring on a service level. So
little bit of cynicism there.
Yes.
Yes. Privacy. Yeah. Well, let's open this up. Who would like to raise some questions? Please give your name and your institution or affiliation if you would like, and then ask your question.
So, I'm Pete Moore, I'm a science writer, communicator. I mean, I'm interested in putting the human back into systems, and I sort of listen to this listening for the human. And it's easy to hear the human disappear. Nigel just gave a list of things that needed to change, and again, the human was missing from it. The people who needed to be involved in the conversation didn't include the human. And it's really, really easy for the patient to slip out. It reminds me of British Airways, who years ago said they loved flying aeroplanes, they just hated the passengers. And we seem to be in a similar sort of spot with this. And the inefficiency of that, I just spent the last weekend putting my neighbour into hospital, who needed to get there, because he was there. It took me 14 phone calls. It involved three separate ambulance crews and four different call-out doctors, all of whom we had to start the story from scratch, none of whom were particularly interested in the person, and each suggested some form of gadget, like a bulb he was throwing up. And the person was seldom involved in the debate. And so the innovation that's needed, to my mind, is to get the person back.
Well, because this is part of my point about social media, because this is about creating these direct interpersonal relationships between the service provider, you know, and...
Yeah, Albert's quadriplegic. He has...
Yeah, I should be tweeting when he's throwing
social media can have a space, so I don't want to discount it. But the innovation will be at the point where social media is really accessible, as opposed to just bolting on another piece of technology.
Who would like to respond to Pete's narrative? We know all the money now is obviously going in your conversations with 14 different crews. This is extraordinary when you think of the inefficiencies. Mm.
Okay. As an anthropologist, I guess that's something that I should have some opinions on, and I do. I think that you're absolutely right. If you think about an illness experience as kind of a controlled experiment, you have two people in the hospital bed side by side with identical broken legs, and you look at their illness experience, and you try to come up with some quantitative data sets around how you treat them and what their satisfaction rates are, and so on and so forth. If the one person broke his leg because the landlord in his apartment building didn't shoveled the stairs in the snowstorm and he fell down and broke it. And the other one broke his leg pushing a child out of the way of an oncoming car. Their perception of their suffering is completely mediated, in other words, by the social circumstances of the engagement. And time and again, patients want to have contact with a real person. And the question is, since they can't, and since increasingly that is highly limited to whatever it is. I mean, we knew long ago that 80% of all diagnoses can be made by doing a careful case history. It takes about 25 minutes. So why are we limiting doctors' time with patients to 6 to 12 minutes? It makes no sense. It makes no economic sense. None whatsoever. If you look at the knock-on effects of misdiagnosis, it's a completely bad decision, but we still do it because we think it's more efficient. So yes, I wholly agree with you. Once you actually have that kind of trust, then the patient will actually tolerate a whole lot more as well. I mean, you know, people talk about business successes. A really good example, everybody talks about Timberland. You can go to The Economist and read stories about, you know, how they had a great success with Timberland Boot Company. I don't have mine on right now, but I'm now on my fifth pair, and every time the soles wear out, I send them back and they give me another pair. But they don't tell you that when you buy it, when you buy your boots. They don't tell you. They don't make promises they can't keep. But if you complain and you feel that you've actually had a bad, you know, clinical experience, they give you more than you ask for. And that transforms your attitude about the service completely. And so I think that you're quite right, that attending to what actually makes people feel better about themselves and how they engage with systems of delivery is fundamentally the place where to begin.
Any other responses?
If I can put something in, I mean, some bits I've cracked. I made the point about shared vision, and I think I can do that. I've cracked it. The bits I haven't cracked is how the hell do you get patients involved in innovation? Because my theory is that something switches. We switch from being a very informed and assertive consumer when Tesco does something to us or Jaguar to patients because we're in an independent relationship. And if we children or babies, how do we communicate anyway? So what he's still looking for is methods, frameworks, whatever, how to really deeply understand and get patients involved that are, you know, maybe nearly dying and so on. On the other hand, and we had this little debate just over a cup of soup, we're all patients. I made the point flippantly, but we're all patients. And maybe it's about finding, you know, what we would want, so having some empathy as well. I find it stunning that you talk to medical engineers and they, you know, it's very, very much about technology, but somehow they don't realize that, you know, their mother-in-law is a patient that is being subjected to poor care.
I was just these numbers, was it yesterday or the day before, published showing that the Metropolitan Police, 27% of Metropolitan Police officers have confidence in the integrity of the Metropolitan Police. Mm. I mean, you know, when you begin to turn these things around, I thought it was really quite profound, isn't it? Mm. Take the pensions of all these people, you know, overlording over the matter of the years. I mean, the bobbies have no confidence in their own leadership. And I think some similar numbers said they would actually have confidence in reporting a crime committed against their own families to their own police force. You turn these things around.
No, just going back to actually whether it's the whole conversation around technology. We tend not to start with the idea that we're going to find a technological solution. We always start with trying to identify what the problem is and framing that within the context that we're dealing with. And actually, that's why we often might have a low-tech, what's called analog solution, and we'll also have a high-tech solution in most projects. Because within service design, there is a lot of talk about social media revolutionising people's lives. But in fact, you know, often you say, "But who is going to go to this website?" Really, there are thousands of websites, there are thousands of apps. But it's really, again, contextualising it from actually specific needs. I mean, interestingly, with the diabetes app, when that project was undertaken, the response from patients were, "Why are you picking on us as a group?" There was actually a lot of hostility, understandably. They said, "Notions of value, why are you talking to us?" And actually, when the student, we said, "Well, actually, you've come up as an example because you're a contained group, and we're creating this prototype." When the prototype was fed back to them, they loved it. They said, "This would really make a difference. Actually, it would really help me to organise actually what my care, my planning for my care." So I think, again, we often find, you know, there's ongoing conversations when we're designing a service. It's not just one moment in time. We're co-designing continuously.
Thank you. Just to pick up the point Daniel made earlier, I think about patient passivity or whatever the term was. Is the fact that the private sector is becoming more and more significant in healthcare delivery in the UK changing that? Or are you basically, people who are using Bupa, basically, are they equally passive?
I don't know. The answer is I don't know. I can only take a guess at this, and my guess would be that superficially services, they might be more assertive. If their lunch or whatever isn't nice enough, I think fundamentally, and I haven't seen the research yet, that something in the brain changes if you are ill, whatever illness this is, because you are in a depending relationship with a doctor and a nurse and so on. And I think that is probably key, and I would assume that affects people in private care as well as.
Maybe NICE will come up with a device which will...
Measure what?
Measure the extent to which people are becoming passive, becoming patients.
I'm sure it's true, but yes, I haven't seen the diagnostic yet.
Okay, who's next? Yes, please.
My name's Mary Adams. I'm a medical anthropologist working in the Biomedical Research Centre at King's, looking at social science engagement. I suppose what interests me is the way technology becomes... the way technology has can become medium of relationship rather than an alternative to clinical relationship. The way clinical relationships and relationships with researchers become shaped around the particular technology that we're talking about. And also what concerns me as a researcher who's been involved in evaluating co-design projects is that is the risk of technology not, instead of it perhaps allowing us to short-circuit some of the more burdensome aspects of a service delivery, that it starts short-circuiting clinical relationships. And for me, that's, in a way, I've got a hope that there will be development of new sorts of relationships coming out of technology, but my fear is that there will be that replacement.
I agree, and I think that's where you have to be, they shouldn't be seen as a substitute. They need to be very carefully balanced in terms of, again, what particular needs are. Mm. So I wouldn't disagree with that at all.
Just to follow up with that, I mean, the example of the drainage system for ascites, I mean, I interviewed breast cancer patients last year who were going home with drainage tubes, 24-hour double mastectomy, then discharge. All fine, you're at home, but where is then the system to back that all up when the tube drops out? You know, who do you contact? And the idea of there being a system that has to support that technology for patients, to enable people, rather than to actually be a very frightening experience.
Integration.
Thank you. I'm visiting professor for innovation, design, and engineering at the RCA, but also visiting professor for the University of the Arts London with St. George St. Martin's. And I also work with technology and teams of technologists and designers.
So you better have a good question in that case.
I said all that, and mine is totally personal at the beginning. And it's going back to the idea of holistic. On one level, my husband had cancer and it had been missed. And there was a new locum. He trained as a sculptor and then retrained to become a doctor or newly trained. And his approach was totally hands-on. It was the way he behaved. And he gave a brilliant diagnosis and arranged for a scan the next day, and he had about 2 weeks to live. It was non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and he had everywhere. And then high tech came in when he was in hospital and having treatment and had a really great relationship with a consultant that explained the technology. And if the technology hadn't been there, he wouldn't have lived. So it was a wonderful sort of relationship between the two. The other way around is at the RCA, with the Innovation Design Engineering students, last year there was a project and it's called Smart Touch. Wonderful idea. It was for young people that wanted to go clubbing and drinking and whatever, had diabetes and don't really want to bother to take their blood test to find out where their level is, or their blood level is. And the Smart Touch didn't work until there was another part, and that was an NGO, because these youngsters were not wanting to take part in this blood taking and bothering to actually take the insulin. But when they found out that the result from their pricking their finger, taking the insulin, could then, by the company providing the insulin, give children in Africa free insulin, they did it. It was like the big issue, and it worked really well. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll round here. Other questions? Yes.
John Danzig, a medical journalist, and a patient with a condition which the NHS cannot afford to adequately. And I just wonder, how on earth are you going to change the culture of a huge, cumbersome, biggest employer in Europe, the NHS, into one that's going to innovate for benefit for the country? Because the innovation I see is totally cost-driven. You're going to cut 25% of the budget, not to benefit humankind, but just to cut costs. How are you on earth going to change the culture of such a large organisation to be orientated to innovate benefit, not just for cost cutting?
Shall I take that?
You respond.
Yeah, I'd quite like to take that, because perhaps perhaps you heard the bit of my talk that was about reducing resources, but not the bit that referred to clinical non-inferiority. So you can't have, you know, there are only two sorts of value that NICE is interested in, which is either it's better and it costs more, or it's clinically non-inferior and overall it releases resources from somewhere in the pathway. There is a third one, which is it's cheaper and it's worse. but we're not really interested in that. So I think it's really important to remember that what we're looking at is products that are, you know, at least as good as the, clinically as good as the alternative. It's just they're releasing resources somewhere in the care pathway because they're kind of shifting the location of care. And I think that's really important because, you know, we're not in the business of recommending things that are cheaper and worse, because that's not value that any sensible person or taxpayer would recognise either.
I'm going to invite our panellists each to make some final comments and they can pick up points from these areas. But any other quick point people would like to make? I'm going to go over here, that's fine.
My name's Naomi. I'm a registered nurse. I'm the inventor of the NeoSlip, which is a simple solution to help put on anti-embolism stockings. I only developed that product as a student nurse. However, my university have really supported me, the enterprise department. But I just wanted to ask Marilla, can you just explain the steps of the, you know, going through the NICE procedure?
Yes, and it sounds as though we probably need to take that up offline, and Matt can give you my email address so you can get in touch and we can have a discussion, but we're certainly very interested in innovations of that nature. Thank you. Well done. I know.
Exactly.
How clever.
Any other quick points? I think it's as interesting as that one.
Not as interesting as that.
Okay. You and then we'll...
I'm Steve Bowley. I'm primarily a patient, but I have had quite a bit of experience in the health service in other ways as well. All I wanted to say really is I think the role of expert patients is key in this. I'm particularly taken with the idea of how we empower groups of patients to be a lot more assertive, to actually drive the health service in the right direction, to look after us as a group, whatever it may be. I'm just interested in comments on that.
That's great. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Pamela McDonald-Kuhn, and I'm a student doing my master's, and I'd be interested in the panel talking a little bit about risk tolerance, because it's one thing to create a culture of innovation, but how do you change the perception that it's okay to take risks?
Good question.
Well, let's move now to have a final comment and pick this up, you're the one with the train.
Yeah, I've got
so
the train.
You can speak first, and you can sit quietly away, and then we'll move down the panel.
I'll say something about expert patients, which is absolutely right, and NICE uses them all the time, and it's a central part of our process, so we'll completely echo that. On the kind of risk education and support, one of the purposes of NICE working in the way that it does is to ensure that when... clinicians and healthcare professionals are using new products or new techniques, new surgical techniques or new approaches, that they're doing it in a way that recognises the current state of the evidence base and the fact that there might be some gaps in the evidence, and also that we ask them when we make our recommendations to actually help by filling the gaps in the evidence by saying very explicitly what it was our committee wasn't sure about when they produced this piece of guidance. And they would possibly like some audit to be done, or they would like some register data to be collected. So I think it's a really good question. And I think the answer to the question of how do you balance risk and innovation is you just keep building the evidence and you get everybody to join you in that.
Now I'm going to move down the panel for final comments. While they are speaking, please take out your evaluation forms. I would not wish to be unduly directive here, but take out your evaluation forms. And please, it's extremely helpful to us to have those filled out. We'll just move, I think, down from the right to the left here.
Right. Well, I think that these last few comments have been very engaging and open up lots of conversations that we don't have time to have right now, but perhaps over drinks we can continue. I want to pick up with the last comment about risk. I think that we are obviously very much disinclined to take risks, especially in the context of circumstances, especially institutional circumstances, where frequently you're punished for taking a risk that doesn't work, but you're not punished for not taking a risk. And we see this all the time in any institution that's endemic, an academic, and it happens all the time. You'll be taken to task for for trying something that doesn't work, but not often taken to task for not trying. I also wanted to comment on the expert patient remark, because it seems to me that that's really very interesting from the standpoint of medical anthropology. We have a number of projects where we're looking at ways of improving doctor-patient relationships among various cohorts. We have a type 2 diabetes project, and we have another one looking at neonatal health care. And one of the things that really strikes me is that if you can level the playing field, then the expert patient can really take the ball and run with it in really interesting ways that oftentimes can actually help to improve services dramatically. But I also think it's important in this context to remember that the whole question of compliance is one that's double-edged. And what I mean here is that I'll give you an example. My primary care doctor, I'm North American, obviously, rural Vermont, two doctors in one practice, and my primary care doctor said, "Oh, it's really easy. We have a great practice. Bill takes all the patients who want to be told what to do, and I take all the patients who want to tell me what they want to do." And I think it's important to remember that, especially when people don't have the opportunity to become expert patients, where the ground rules aren't actually, the playing field isn't level, that we be aware of the fact that people still do need, and oftentimes very much want guidance in clinical settings, and that we have to be careful. It's hard to get money for anything today unless there's a patient empowerment component for research. But that's also another way of divesting oneself of the responsibility of looking after that patient. That is to say, give them the tools. You know, do you build better wheelchair ramps, or do you give people bionic limbs and tell them to get on with it? You know, it's a tough moral and ethical question. And so I think that it comes down in some ways. And I will finish here, I think the best clinical encounters are ones in which people are given options that are real to them that they haven't thought of. You know, whether that's a new therapeutic treatment that wasn't available to them earlier, or whether it's just a different way of thinking about the way they cope with something that they may have to live with for a very long time. And that can only happen, I think, when you have a good personal encounter with somebody. And insofar as that becomes rare, I think we should treat it with more care.
Okay, let's make this personal. I think your question resonates with me. Why? I grew up in Holland, watched James Herriot. I thought, I want to be a vet. And very soon I got the idea that actually vets have to kill animals because of economic stuff. Okay, then I thought, I'll become a doctor. And I was a junior house officer a long time ago in Holland. I was actually confronted with the same economic truth. You know, I was an idealist, and healthcare is actually happening. You have to make economic-based decisions, and I got out as soon as I could. So that hasn't been, it's not around now, it's been around for a long time. So what am I doing now? I think policy has created a wonderful opportunity, because now we've got clinical commission groups. I'm not sure it's going to work, but it's desperately trying to get patient outcomes and patient-centered care much closer to where patients are, driven by GPs. I know it's not, you know, so what I'm doing personally is working with a couple of clinical commissioning groups, helping them to understand what innovation actually is, to desperately try and get healthcare, you know, being patient-focused and being patient-centered again. So I think there's actually a policy opportunity, an opportunity curated by policy that we just, I think, have to focus on.
Thank you.
Focusing on risk, design allows a lot of risk to take place because of its very nature of prototyping. Whatever service we're working on, we always prototype, whether it's very well called dirty prototyping or much more sophisticated. And actually, I think by allowing those concepts to be tried and tested, you are reducing risk. And also the fact that, strangely, I think it's often taken for granted, but the visualization processes that we go through, I did mention, it makes it very democratic, and and it's very transformative. And I think that really helps in terms of, again, engaging patient experts. So actually, sometimes you have people say, oh, but you always get one patient who will dominate, and actually what you'll get one person's view coming through, and you need to get this cross-section of opinions. But actually when we run workshops, and not just in healthcare, but we run some with geomedia and ordnance survey, when you the visualization and the methods that we use are they really do allow dialogue to take place, and it's not just being dominated by bullet points and somebody writing notes. And then actually those are translated into concepts, and you're constantly getting feedback. And that sounds all very idealised and very time-consuming, but when we've worked with Cranfield, with the health school, again with medical technology, they've often said to us, oh, we don't need the patients until 2 years down the line. And actually, if you engage the patients early on in the technological inception, really, you're going to actually reduce your risk. So we push for that whenever we're working with health researchers, let's say, at Cranfield. And the idea is the earlier you bring in the user, actually, the user perspective and the service design framework, the probably less likelihood of failure at the end.
Thank you. A couple of remarks as I've been absorbing this. I think quite fascinating discussion. I mean, my sense is that not least of one of you in the room here as well, we could just set this panel up to run this whole enterprise for for the NHS, because it's quite fascinating interlocking perspectives from different disciplines and somewhat from obviously from different angles also. Three comments. One is as we began with, and of course this is titled The Significance of Culture. And the significance of several different levels, the word can mean a lot of different things. And probably in every single potential meaning of the term culture, it's highly relevant to this discussion. But the fundamental assumptions people are bringing to this situation, often unexamined assumptions, inside and outside of the health service itself, are plainly at the heart of the challenges that we face in innovation. And the need for integrative thinking, not interdisciplinary, as this panel has been, and we could, of course, have brought in other disciplines and other perspectives and individuals, but constantly to be engaging in this interdisciplinary conversation and ensuring that we don't let it go by default. Because, of course, you know, the problem of salience, we all tend to work within our own disciplines and fall back into them when we're not being pushed into the interdisciplinary discussion. Secondly, a comment, of course, on the innovation cost, you know, interrelationship. And of course it is the case that we have, you know, in the last 20 years through new technology developments, we have this thing called search, we have social media connections, we can sit and chat people all over the world basically for nothing all of the time. Some enormous things have developed through technology which basically are in effect free, which previously were unobtainable or extraordinarily expensive. And so this isn't naive to say that because you have Moore's Law, technology will drive innovation and costs will go down. But I think non-naively, I think one has to work within a context in which costs ultimately are contained. Interestingly, picking up the patient passivity, of course, from my point of view, the one example we see of patient activism in the UK tends simply to be about resources. I mean, about resources in a sort of, you know, very general sense. We want money for this, we should be more money, we'll complain against cuts, and we want to reopen a ward, that kind of thing. Which is, in a sense, the least relevant kind of participation that one seeks. Because, of course, not least, because costs do have to be contained. And this is the baseline experience, which we're slowly coming to terms with as these curves go up steeper. And thirdly, potential for the expert patient. I mean, most people are actually very smart, as we know. And when we deal with people who are often uneducated and non-professional and so on, they can be extraordinarily smart in the way they handle all sorts of situations. And I think part of the task here is to let loose that kind of smartness and to provide the kind of confidence which it needs perhaps to be fed with. And of course, not least use technology so we can have medicine 2.0, like we have government 2.0, enterprise 2.0. What it does interest me, if I want to be my final remark here, is hardly a word has been said on the panel about international comparisons and the global situation, whether the sort of American-type global situation or the developing world global situation, in both of which contexts, for very different reasons, a lot of innovation is taking place. And it seems to me framing this as a global conversation ultimately is central. Thank you very much for the panel. This has been just a delightful afternoon.
Thank you.
leave your innovation. Leave your evaluations on your seats, or pass them to Debbie at the back. We have the reception in these rooms behind me here, and we hope you will stay and join and talk. And we will be having this online, so you can download it, and there'll be a documentary version of the conversation. Thank you very much.